Hey, welcome along. I hope you had a good Father's Day. If you're American, here is your founding father. Whoops, sorry. I mean your floundering father.
Well, we're going to win and we're going to help. We have plans to build a railroad from the Pacific all the way across the Indian Ocean. We have plans to build in Angola, one of the largest solar plants in the world. I can go on, but I'm not. I'm going off script. I'm going to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Going to get in trouble with who? You're supposed to be the number one guy in America. In a railway across the Pacific Ocean and from there across the Indian Ocean. As Florida Governor Ron DeSantis marveled. Ambitious. Look at that thing. Joe Biden's engineers are going to be laying track over the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest oceanic trench on Earth. If you put Mount Everest in the Mariana Trench, its peak would still be 1.3 miles underwater. Look at it. There's the tallest place on Earth sitting in the deepest place on Earth. As I said, if you put Mount Everest in the Mariana Trench, it's still going to be 1.3 miles underwater. So that is going to be the longest golden spike ever hammered in the history of railroading. Not like in those days. Did any of the so-called mainstream media, your trusted news sources, cover the announcement of this ambitious 8,000-mile engineering project across the international dateline? No, not the New York Times, the Washington Post, ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, BBC. This stunning announcement went entirely uncommented on at those prestigious news organizations. 2 days later, Joe Biden was in Connecticut and ended his speech thus.
All right. God save the Queen, man.
Yeah, and there he is trying to figure out how to get off the stage. And then when his minder shows up, he starts galloping as if to show that he is a fit, healthy man, full of purpose. Why did he say, God save the Queen, to an audience in Connecticut? No idea, but again, nothing about it in any of the trusted media outlets you've heard of. Oh, and another. Here's Joe Biden welcoming the actress Eva Longoria to the White House. I think that's what they call a warm welcome, because that's how the ladies like it, right under the breasts like that. There, you can't go wrong with that maneuver. Anyway, after that warm welcome, he then said,
we've known each other a long time. She was 17, I was 40. That's it. But thank you, and the entire cast and crew and everyone involved.
Yeah, we've known each other a long time. She was 17, I was 40. Actually, when Joe Biden was 40, Eva Longoria was 7, which is right in the demographic he prefers for his hair sniffing. Again, what does he mean by this remark? The New York Times, CNN, they all declined to say. But what we do know for sure is that this man is not the chief executive of the global superpower. He is the dead husk of a moth-eaten sock puppet being waggled around by others. It would be nice to know by whom, but again, the Washington Post and NBC News declined to take any interest in the topic. Do you remember Trump and George W. Bush? The slightest verbal infelicity would be seized on by the press and be forensically analyzed for days. Not anymore. All my life, I have been told that back in the 1930s, the American press declined to tell the American people that their president, Franklin Roosevelt, was a paraplegic. That's not strictly true. The US media were much livelier and more diverse in those days, and publishers politically opposed to FDR would occasionally run photos of him in an apparent wheelchair, but such pictures infuriated the White House. And if, for example, the Secret Service saw newsmen snapping the president as he was being lifted out of his car, they would seize the newsmen's cameras, rip out the film, and smash the plates. They no longer need to do that because America's legacy media are content to serve as court eunuchs. The emperor has no marbles. He's falling down in public. Over and over. He's spouting mumbo jumbo. He's providing disturbing glimpses of what remains of his interior life by doing 1970s jailbait jokes to 2020s actresses. The emperor has no marbles, and yet the entire media play along, and woe betide anyone who doesn't. That's the only thing Hans Christian Andersen got wrong in his famous fairy tale.
People lined the streets as the artillery came by, and the infantry came by, and the cavalry came by, and the fife and drum corps, and the royal guard, and finally, the king. And everybody cheered, hooray! Because nobody wanted to appear a fool. Nobody, that is, except one little boy who, for some strange reason, hadn't heard about the king's new magic suit, and didn't know what he was supposed to see. Well, he took one look at the king, turned a little pale, and said, "Look at the king, look at the king, look at the king, the king, the king. The king is in the altogether, but altogether, the altogether, he's altogether as naked as the day that he was born. The king's in the altogether, but altogether, the altogether, it's altogether the very least the king has ever worn. Call the court physician, call an intermission. His Majesty is wide open to ridicule and scorn."
His Majesty is wide open to ridicule and scorn. He is, but you'd be surprised. You can beseech God to save an already dead queen and preserve your railway lines as they skim across the Pacific waters to China and onward to Kenya. And nobody who matters will ridicule and scorn you. As I said, that's the bit that Hans Christian Andersen got wrong. Today, with a little boy to point out that the emperor has no clothes, the enraged crowd would beat him to a pulp for peddling disinformation. You'd never know he existed, because that little boy's Facebook and Instagram accounts would be instantly vaporized. The US Constitution vests executive authority in its chief magistrate, the president. But he's in the basement eating tapioca and watching Matlock reruns.
Well, there you are.
Yeah.
Oh, hot dog.
175.
One.
So who actually is the President of the United States? Come to that, who actually is the junior senator from Pennsylvania? The other day in Philadelphia, part of I-95, the principal north-south highway down the east coast of America, collapsed. So this critical federal artery is currently closed. Senator John Fetterman was asked if he'd like to comment on this major event in his state.
Earlier today, some comments about the tragic accident in 995. And if you want to make any comments with respect to that, feel free. You're recognized.
I would really like to, you know, the 95, you know. Obviously, you're pretty much preoccupied with 95.
95, 95, 95. John Fetterman isn't 95, unlike Joe Biden. He was elected last year, even though he's had a major stroke. This is a rather poignant news story. The collapse of Interstate 95 is emblematic of the decrepitude both of American infrastructure and of the political class that presides over it. Just to underline the latter point, here's Senator Fetterman introducing Joe Biden.
And now I'm standing next to the president again, next to a collapsed bridge here. And he is here to commit to work with the governor and the delegation to make sure that we get this fixed quick, fast as well, too. This is a president that is committed to infrastructure. Yeah, and then on top of that, the jewel law of the infrastructure bill that is going to make sure that there's going to be bridges all across like this, all across the America getting rebuilt.
Yeah, I'm standing next to a collapsed bridge here. Indeed you are. What most offended America's political industrial complex about Donald J. Trump in 2016? He was all candidate and no minders. I know, I was there backstage, and I have never seen an American candidate with a smaller entourage. All candidate and no minders. If that were to catch on, who knows where it might lead. So Trump was taken out by his precise opposite, Joe Biden, a guy who's all minders and no candidates. Same with that fella Fetterman, same with California Senator Dianne Feinstein, same with the senator I got into a ding-dong with at a Senate hearing a couple of years back, Ed Markey from Massachusetts. Absolutely useless unless he's being fed his lines from the staffers behind him. It's almost like the central framing of our politics. As runners in a horse race, who's up, who's down, who's ahead, is entirely irrelevant to what's really going on. We live in a blizzard of lies, by which I don't mean merely that this man is self-evidently not the leader of the free world. No, I don't think so. But I don't just mean that. I mean also that the blizzard swirls to envelop everything. What, for example, is the takeaway from this across the Atlantic? A party at Conservative Party headquarters in London just before Christmas 2020. Laura? That really could be a scene from the thick of it, couldn't it? The dreadful anonymous room, the sad drinks table, the lumpy, leaden, ungroovy grooving of the desperate staffers in their hideous Christmas sweaters. But it took place in December 2020, the year that COVID cancelled Christmas for everybody else, because it was too dangerous to let you be in the same room as Grandpa and Auntie Mabel. And what that video shows us is that it wasn't dangerous at all. And the people who govern you knew it wasn't dangerous. They're not wearing masks. They're not socially distancing. Indeed, that arrhythmic couple looks like a few more drinks and they'll be getting as socially non-distanced as you can get. But because of the central lie of the COVID years, your granny died alone, entirely unsurrounded by loved ones. The same people who came up with that awful bullying, look him in the eyes campaign. Ooh, look him in the eyes and tell him COVID isn't real. The look him in the eyes guys are looking at that chickie's cleavage and fancying their chances. Let's get the COVID party started because Project Fair is bollocks. That's bad. But if you're a UK voter, what are you going to do about it? Disdain the unlovely Tories and vote Labour or Lib Dem at the next election? Those guys wanted even more lockdown. So did the Scottish National Party and Sinn Féin. Those guys want to leave the UK in order to set up a country with even more phony baloney lockdown than the one they've just left. We'll have more on this a bit later on with Maya Tusi. A blizzard of lies on all fronts, all issues, yet bolstered by, quote, disinformation monitors and fact checkers funded by woke billionaires, all designed to ensure that nothing pierces the official propaganda. As you know, I'm taking the UK state censor Ofcom. That's their two chief commissars, Lord Grade and Dame Melanie Dawes. I'm taking the state censors to the King's Bench Division and asking the High Court to quash their ruling against me that my advice to viewers that it might not be in your interest to get the COVID booster shot, the third jabber jabber, the fourth jabber jabber, the fifth on and on. It might not be in your interest to get the COVID booster shot, that was, quote, harmful, according to Ofcom. Really? Brand new study from the super prestigious Cleveland Clinic. Being up to date with your COVID boosters increases your chances of getting COVID by 33%. So the only people being, quote, harmful here are the propagandists, the ones determined to maintain the official narrative no matter how many people it injures and kills. A blizzard of lies. A blizzard of lies maintained by ruthless enforcers in the media on behalf of the state. That's why I'm dragging Michael Grade and Melanie Dawes into court and shoving their pseudo-jurisprudence down their gullets. I'm the first UK presenter to take Ofcom to court in a decade and a half. And I say to my former telly and radio colleagues, come on in, the water's fine. You'll enjoy getting Chief Censor Grade into the witness box. I've been very touched by the number of viewers who said, oh, we'd love to help you get Lord Grade and Dame Melanie testifying under oath. And I said, well, there's multiple ways to support my lawsuit. And I've been asked to reprise those. So very quickly, you can lend a helping hand by buying a chum a Stein Online gift certificate or by treating a loved one to a Mark Stein Club membership. They'll thank you forever. Or by pre-ordering my aforementioned new book, which is very timely. If you're one of His Majesty's subjects, and you'll enjoy a massive titter or three. It's way funnier than Joe Biden, even when he's falling down. This is the Mark Stein Show across the planet. We have lots more to come, including the first of tonight's terrific guests, Dr. Claire Craig, coming up. Don't touch that dial.
A remote, fantastical kingdom, far from Europe's chancelleries of power. An ancient castle where secrets are walled up. An unpopular monarch on the eve of his coronation. A ruling class of plotters and would-be usurpers. And a gentleman adventurer on holiday. No, not Ruritania in the 19th century, but the United Kingdom in the 21st. Stein's new book, The Prisoner of Windsor, is a contemporary inversion of Anthony Hope's classic, The Prisoner of Zender. In the original, an English gentleman on vacation is called upon to stand in for his lookalike, the King of Ruritania, at his coronation. Over a century later, a Ruritanian on vacation in London is called upon to return the favour and stand in for an Englishman in an absurd, fantastical kingdom where Brexit never quite happened. Plots are afoot. The Prisoner of Windsor by Mark Stein. Available in hardback and digital editions, or for a personally autographed copy, go to steinonline.com.
Well, it's timely, I'll say that, and people seem to like it. The five-star reviews are piling up. Wayne, a first hour founding member of the Mark Stein Club. He joined quickly. He writes, is there a wordsmith living who is as witty and entertaining as Mark Stein? Don't shout out thousands of names. It's a rhetorical question. Is there a modern novel as rich and imaginative as The Prisoner of Windsor? This book is what future generations will call literature. It is a classic that we can enjoy now. Well, I don't know about that, Wayne, but it's awfully kind of you. I was speaking about this new study from the prestigious Cleveland Clinic in America showing how well these boosters work. These boosters work so well that they boost your chances of getting COVID by one-third. That seems odd for something marketed as not only a vaccine, but as an effective one, notwithstanding all its safety issues. The pathologist Claire Craig is back with us, and we are always glad to see her. Claire, basically, ever since this stuff started, the facts have been moving relentlessly in your direction, and yet they, generally speaking, go uncovered in the media. Do you think the Cleveland Clinic study is just going to disappear into the void, or are people actually beginning to get the reality of what's going on here?
So actually, Mark, this is the second Cleveland study. So the first Cleveland study came out in December 2022. And this is a study of 48,000 healthcare workers. Yep. And you can just imagine the research team seeing their results. So their results showed that with the more doses people had, the higher the rate of COVID infections. So it was doing the opposite of what had been promised in a dangerous way. And that team must have thought, right, we've got to get this out there. It's going to change everything. You know, this is so important. It went out into December 2022. Nothing's happened, has it? And they were criticized for it not being peer reviewed. That paper now is peer reviewed and published. And they've come out with another paper, presumably thinking, well, that didn't work. Let's have, you know, we better look at it from a different angle and see if we can get people to understand it in a different way. And so they looked at it again. And this time they looked just from January of this year and said, well, what's the rate of infection among people who are up to date with their vaccines, meaning they've had the very latest booster, or not up to date, which could mean any other category.
Hmm.
And there's this funny thing that goes on in science at the moment, where people will find results and share the results honestly, and then write something quite different in their paper. And what they've done, this Cleveland group, is in the discussion, in their conclusions, they've concluded that the reason for the difference is that the people who weren't up to date were likely to have had a BA4 or BA5 variant infection. So that's the Omicron variant that was around end of 2022, beginning of 2023. And that's why there's a difference. But in their own results, they have already broken that down. So they had a look at the people who'd had a recent infection, and they have low rates of subsequent infection, and it's identical. For, it doesn't matter how vaccinated you are, you've been infected, you're immune for a bit. And then they looked at the ones that hadn't had a recent infection, and the ones that were up to date had an infection rate a third higher than the ones not up to date. So that was not the reason.
Mm.
And yet they write that in their discussion, presumably in an attempt to get it peer reviewed and published, because there is this bizarre thing going on where you have to conform to scriptures and make these statements in the papers in order to get the results out there. It's really ridiculous.
Yeah, you're right on, certainly right on that. The first Cleveland Clinic study, which, as you said, came out a few months ago. The interesting thing about that is this is almost 50,000 people who are actually the clinic's employees. And because of federal vaccine mandates, these guys were, a huge number of them were obliged to be vaccinated just in order to get into the building and continue holding their jobs. And no matter how they try to finesse it, the reality is that this thing is doing the opposite of what an effective vaccine is meant to doing. It's not eliminating or even decreasing your chances of getting the disease in question. It's actually increasing them. That's the basic reality. As you say, they can sort of dodge and weave to get it past the peer reviewers or whatever. But that core reality is a devastating indictment of the propaganda of the last 2.5 years, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And if you think back to the kinds of things that have been said about the unvaccinated, putting people at risk because they're more risk of infection, you can now invert all of those comments and make them about the people who are up to date with their vaccinations, because they are the ones at greatest risk of infection now. Now, of course, we're not going to invert those comments because we're not like that. But it really goes to show how much, you know, it really, really brings into focus the propaganda that we've had when you see it like that. And I think it's worth asking the question about why is this happening, right? This is, you know, this is something that I'm sure anybody who's vaccinated will want to try and understand. And there might be a variety of reasons why it might be happening, but the one that has the most evidence behind it is that when you, if you think about how an immune system works, the job of an immune system is to recognize what belongs to you, what's yourself, and what is foreign. That's all that it does. But it also mustn't recognize food as foreign. You don't want it attacking your food, or you'll have an allergy. So there's a sort of sideshow that it does, where it recognizes food and it switches the immune response to say, well, we can ignore that even though it's foreign, because we don't want to attack it. And that is what's been happening with people. The more injections they're getting, the more their immune system is switching over to say, we can ignore that. And so if you've got an immune system deliberately ignoring something that's foreign, of course you're going to have more infections.
Yeah, that's actually a very good way of putting it, that in fact, the more boosters you have, the more you are misdirecting your immune system to ignore things that will at some point become harmful to you?
Well, I mean, the thing is that it's a foreign agent, and it's something you want an immune response to. Mm. And if the human intervention is teaching people's immune system not to respond to it, then that's catastrophic. You know, that's doing absolutely the opposite of what you want. And I mean, you know, I've said it a million times, but we've got to stop doing this. We've got to stop. It's ridiculous. It's still going on. It's absolutely crazy that this is still going on and people are still being injected.
Well, certain people have figured that out, not in the United States, not in the big five at the, not the big guys at the G7, but on the periphery. The Scandinavian countries started by first saying, oh, we're not going to recommend it for under 18s, under 50s, under 65s. And then Switzerland just cut to the chase and said, we're not going to recommend it to anybody. The AstraZeneca has effectively been withdrawn in the UK. Johnson & Johnson has been withdrawn in the United States. I think at some point the way to bet is that the remaining vaccines will just be shuffled off the table quietly. But that's the point. They're basically trying to roll back the last 2.5 years on the sly, on the quiet, as if there should be no accounting for it.
They are doing that, but they are also continuing to pressurize people into having it. So obviously, not me, but you know, my parents and my parents' friends who are in their 70s and 80s, these people are still getting text messages regularly from the NHS. One of them I know who has not had COVID yet, so I would say has a pretty good immune system, because there's absolutely no doubt they'd have been exposed several times by now.
Yeah,
being told that they are immune compromised. They're not immune compromised in any way, and that they need to have another jab. And you know, I think that there's always been this thing, hasn't there, about, well, let's talk about the vulnerable in a different category. But what this evidence is showing is that this is a really, really bad idea if you're vulnerable. It's a really bad idea.
Yeah, so you're not one of the, I mean, the kind of modified, qualified, stage by stage withdrawal that we've seen in some countries where they, well, maybe if you're a young man, you should think twice about this. Okay, maybe we don't need to immunize every toddler under 5 years old. They're still, even as they retreat, they're still claiming there are benefits for this thing once you get up into your 70s and 80s. And as I, just as a layman, when you look at that, I don't actually see that. I don't see the evidence for the idea that if you're 87 or you're 94 or you're 112, it's in your interest to take these things.
So I think that sometimes the evidence has been really difficult to interpret on this. That's the trouble, because there's a lot of biases in it and you never really know how you can unpick it. So you have to try and look at the big picture as much as you can. I would say that the detailed evidence, if you like, has always suggested that the mortality rate was higher in the unvaccinated elderly people than in the vaccinated. But the case fatality rate wasn't, that was about the same. And so that sort of throws it all out, because that doesn't make sense. And furthermore, that the working out the fatality rate is entirely dependent on understanding how many people there are in the population. And because what you want to do is say, well, there are this many deaths per this many people. And we can do that quite well for the vaccinated, because we counted them as they were being jabbed, right? So we've got an actual measurement of how many people were jabbed in each age group. But to work out how many people weren't jabbed, you have to know how many people are in the country, and then you subtract how many were vaccinated. And we don't know how many people are in the country. It's a guess. It's not a measurement. It's a guess. And in fact, for people in their 70s, for almost every region that the ONS has measured, there are more vaccinated people than they say exist, right? So when you've got that situation, the number of people that you are saying are unvaccinated is a made up number. And if you make up a number that's too small, you're going to end up with a scary death rate, because you've got this many deaths per not very many people. And so you have to, you know, you have to accept that that data has got huge confidence intervals. We don't really know the answer. And then you take a step back and say, right, if this was working to save the lives of people at all, it's mostly going to have been saving the elderly's lives because they're the ones at risk of dying, then we should see an impact on, say, the size of a wave or the duration of a wave pre-vaccine compared with post-vaccine. And in the UK, there kind of was, actually. Delta did look quite different. It was flattened off, although the total numbers, once you measured it across the full time frame, were still quite bad. But if you look at Europe or the US, then the death curve for Delta looks just like the previous ones. The hospitalization curve looks just like the previous ones. I think, well, hang on a second, guys. You are putting huge emphasis on this idea that there were tons more cases. This is something we have never measured before. With influenza, we have measured hospitalizations and deaths. And with influenza, we see similar sized waves each season and with each wave. And that's what we've had with COVID, similar sized waves, pre-vax and post-vax. And then you can look at how many people have died over time across the world. And what you see is there's a sort of steady accumulation of people who have died of COVID on a graph. And you get to Omicron, and this steep gradient of deaths that are accumulating dips down because it's not as deadly. So you've got a changing gradient from the people dying, accumulating, and it dips down. There is no alteration in that gradient because of vaccination. It was incessant. It just carried on. If anything, it got a little bit worse looking. So you can't say that the vaccines changed that. It didn't.
That's a very interesting way of looking at it. As you say, the case numbers is an entirely new metric compared to how we look at anything. You know, at any time of the day, but you know, there are millions and millions of people wandering around with dozens and dozens of medical conditions they're not even aware of. If you were to test for anything the way you test for COVID, you would think there was an epidemic of all kinds of things going on, simply because people are asymptomatic, they're not even aware they're carrying it. Why do you think that governments around the world chose that particular metric? And then the media in particular, if you remember the COVID years where they'd have the ticker in the corner of the screen showing the case numbers, the positive test results, just going up continually, minute by minute, day by day, week by week. Why do you think that metric was universally agreed upon to be the one that counted?
So if you buy into the idea that we were at the beginning of an epidemic, then at the beginning of an epidemic, you want to be measuring something before you start measuring deaths. You want to be prepared for the hospitals to start, you know, people are going to, you need a warning sort of system. So you've got some knowledge about what's about to happen. So from that point of view, I think it's reasonable to try and do a measurement of cases, even if it is in the hospital. And also at the beginning, when you're setting things up rapidly, because, you know, you haven't got time, you might make compromises on how you do that testing. And the kind of compromises are that you are going to overcall because you don't want to miss any cases because you're still at a stage where you think you can control it. I don't think it can be controlled, by the way. I think that there's a myth around close contact spread being the only method of spread, but that was the belief system that we were working with, right? So I think it's reasonable in that belief system to start out with that intention. Very, very soon after starting that, though, there was this thing that happened where countries started publishing their data. And there was this sort of competition between the countries to all be publishing a daily case rate and a daily death rate. And so it became, you know, I think it was literally competition between the countries making that happen and driving it and sticking it on the news. And then it sort of becomes self-fulfilling because people start to want to know because, you know, it was yesterday, what is it tomorrow? And the fact it took so long to stop doing that was quite extraordinary, really quite extraordinary. And that what was really bad was that at no point, and this should have happened at the latest when we got to peak deaths. At peak deaths, you say, right, guys, we've got to reassess this now. Because if we're still chasing down every possible case and not caring if we're overdiagnosing, then we're going to cause harm. Yeah. And so we have to have a different strategy now. And the strategy for testing has to be not at the individual level anymore. You start to have a strategy that's at a population level. And you say, we only want to identify definite outbreaks. Yeah. And so once you've got a definite outbreak, you can sort of be a bit more generous and say, well, how many possible cases are there in that definite outbreak? But we didn't. We just stuck with possible cases right the way through, even through summer time when, you know, there wasn't really much virus around at all. And at that point, it was really harmful because the vast majority of people coming back positive had no symptoms, never developed antibodies, and yet they were actually fine.
No, you're absolutely right, Claire. And there's still certain areas of life in which you still have to be COVID tested to get inside the building. I happen to know I've been in and out of hospital on both sides of the border in two different countries the last week and a half. And in the United States, in hospitals, they're still jabbing the stupid thing up your nose. And still insisting on taking, I've got all kinds of other things wrong with me, but I'm completely clear of the COVID. It's very frustrating that this is all they're interested in. Thank you very much, Dr. Claire Craig. We are always pleased to see you. This is the Mark Slide Show. We're coming right back in 30 seconds.
This is Mark Stein. After 3 years in COVID stan, it's time to get out of town. So join me on the 2023 Mark Stein Cruise, sailing from Italy to Croatia, Montenegro, Greece, for a full week of sun, sea and civilizational collapse. I'll have special guests from around the world, from America, Canada, Australia, Britain, Europe, and we'll do all the things you like about the Mark Stein Show and Stein Online, but close up and on water. More details at steinonline.com or marksteincruise.com.
Yeah, our Neptune suites, which are pretty swanky, have sold out. Although some customers are concerned that what with my aforementioned ailing health, my stateroom may be opening up any day now. I can't promise the Mark Stein cruise will be as much fun as a lockdown party with conservative staffers in their wearing their Christmas sweaters, but we shall certainly try. Maya Tusi, who is a big star on YouTube, is back with us. You know, cake, wine in a suitcase. Meanwhile, there's 1,000 excess deaths a week in England and Wales, on and on and on and on. The NHS has packed up. It takes 2 business days for an ambulance to arrive. But let's talk about Partygate and wine in a suitcase for another year and a half. What do you make of this? Are you envious that you weren't invited to that cracking Tory party?
So there are a couple of issues. Firstly, thanks for having me on the show, Mark. One, on behalf of all British people and the rest of the world, I'm offended that they call that a party. that was absolutely embarrassing. Secondly, also a bunch of lightweights. Secondly, you're absolutely spot on. Obviously, it seems to be a distraction tactic from the media, maybe not necessarily in an Illuminati way, having a meeting, secret meeting, have all decided, but it's a culture, it's a toxic culture in the media. It's in their blood that they focus on the Westminster gossip politics. But even when they do that, they mess it up. Even when they're focusing on, for example, Partygate, which is now 2 years old, and instead of focusing on all the important issues you mentioned, they are still manipulating the public, even on this. But actually, I'm glad it's happening because obviously, for those who haven't watched, so much has happened over the last couple of weeks. You know, Boris Johnson's Privileges Committee found him guilty, even though they're not the legal court. Then one of the members of the Privileges Committee themselves attended the party, apparently, allegedly. And you got Sue Gray, who was in charge of the investigation. All this is actually exposing the establishment themselves. So while they're trying to use that to target Boris Johnson, because they think Boris Johnson is some sort of right-wing threat, Boris Johnson of all people, in reality, they're actually making a mess because people can actually see them for who they are, just like the European Union. For decades, people didn't see the real face of the European Union until the Brexit negotiations started. Then they saw them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I'm distracted by this idea of Boris Johnson as a right-wing threat. I wish. Yeah. I've known him for a third of a century, and he has never seemed less of a right-wing threat. But let me ask you what I think is the most interesting point about this, because as I mentioned at the top of the show, all the other parties were in favour of even more lockdown. Labour, Lib Dems, Scottish Nationalists, Sinn Féin, whoever you want to name, they all wanted actually more lockdown than the lockdown they were given. So now we have this exposure of, you know, lockdown as some kind of hypocritical racket. But as you mentioned, the media are the ones who, in some strange way, are the ones who are most gung-ho about the idea that the integrity of the lockdown should be preserved and maintained. And if you go back, that's what's actually so weird about Partygate and all the rest of it, is that the media seem more invested in the integrity of the lockdown than any of the politicians do.
Yeah, I mean, what they don't see, they clearly don't read the room, the media and the political establishment. The general public who are angry or outraged because of all this Partygate stuff and the new video of the Tory central office dancing, they're outraged mostly, majority, because they believe at this point, after all these years, that the rules were ridiculous. But you forced us to do it, but you didn't do it. Whereas the media establishment and the liberal left and the whole of the governance of the country, what they see is, well, these rules were important and you destroyed the integrity of the rules. That's not why people are angry. People are angry because the rules were already ridiculous. A lot of people broke the rules, but they're going to trouble. But they can see all this video footage and everything else. But again, there's a double standards as well. Because when Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, was caught drinking beer and eating curry with all his friends and Angela Rayner, the police decided not to investigate that. Even the recent incident of the senior member of the Privileges Committee, Bernard Jenkin, who brought Boris Johnson down, he was caught there. He was at a birthday party and there was indeed a cake available. The police decided not to investigate that either because it's a historic matter. We don't look at the historic matters unless it's Boris Johnson or Donald Trump.
Yeah, what I find, you know, I'm sympathetic to that because we had people on the show last year, people who had fines of £300, £500 because they were caught by police drinking with two mates in their back gardens or whatever. So these things were policed and enforced upon ordinary people. But in a strictly political context, how does this actually play out? Does it damage Johnson? Does it damage Sunak? Does it make it more likely that Keir Starmer, guzzling down his beer and his curry, is going to be in number 10? How do the politics play out?
Yeah, I think that you can't damage Boris Johnson. He's made of mud. You can't throw mud at mud. So no one's like shocked. The story is already old and boring. Keir Starmer will get away with it, surprisingly. He would be seen as Mr. Integrity, even though, again, he's a hypocrite. Rishi Sunak will be the one who will be mostly damaged. And it's mostly his own doing. Not only the fact that Rishi Sunak was also at those parties, yet at the same time, there's no outrage about that. He misled Parliament as well, if you want to focus on that sort of nonsense. He misled Parliament as well. But he can't hold his party together. We don't even know what the Conservative Party stands for. He doesn't know what it stands for. So that's how he's going to damage it. Obviously, it's damaging the constitution of this country, but obviously it's not codified British constitution, but parliamentary procedure is mostly completely undermining the little bit of integrity that we had in Parliament.
Yeah.
Obviously, over the last few years, we've been losing that. But this new class of MPs are completely destroying that. It's nothing to do with just Boris Johnson. It's all of them.
Yeah. There is some political space, one would have thought, for a party that would actually stand up and say, you know, the last 3 years were madness. We're not doing it again. We should have an amnesty for all lockdown infringements and return all the fines. I don't even care who would be that party, whether it's Tories, Labour, Democratic Unionists, Sinn Féin, but you would have thought there would be some opportunity for some party to go there.
Yeah, no, and I mean, there isn't, unfortunately, mostly because partly the British culture compared to the revolutionary cultures like the French, who are ready to burn cars every Tuesday when there's a tax hike, and it goes further sometimes. Sometimes it goes too far. The British culture, people just like, I don't want to know. I'm just going to remain ignorant. It's not really an insult. It's not really like they're making a choice. They're not idiots. But so what they do is they depend on the consensus, which is created, the narrative, by the mainstream media. So there will be a few. There will be a lot of people, including those who watch my channel, for example, who are waking up and everything else. And some people will be left-wing, some people will be right-wing. But the majority of the country who are busy paying their bills and going to work, they, at the end of the day, they will hardly even care or know who the deputy leader of the Labour Party is, or the Tories, even though it's government. And they, when the election comes, they just listen to what the BBC or Sky News would say. And they would just assume in their head, subconsciously, you only have two choices, red or blue. Yeah. And that's the problem. Yeah. So, and then Nigel Farage obviously broke that a while ago, only short term. And that was UKIP for the cause of the Brexit referendum. And even that was a short term success, because it was just because there was a cause.
Yeah.
It was not really sustainable. And even Nigel Farage went away.
Yeah, no, no, you're right. And you're absolutely right, by the way, that no self-respecting person anywhere on the planet would call that a party. And if you had, if you or I walked into that room, the first thing you'd say is, oh my God, this is terrible. We've got to get out of here before anybody snaps a photograph of us. Taxi, and we'd be gone. It's pathetic.
if these guys... Want to know what a party is? They don't want to know what I was up to during the lockdown. I'm not admitting anything. I don't want the police to knock on my door. But
okay. Get ready for this. There's going to be a lot of lockdown boasting of that kind. Yeah, you don't want to know where I was on that night. Thank you very much, mate. Always great to see you. We pride ourselves on having a global audience here. We've got viewers from London, Ontario, to London, England, even London, Kentucky, and certainly London, Kiribati. And no matter where you are, inflation is rampant. Eggs are now a luxury item. At one point, it was all the rage to blame Putin for inflation. That was Joe Biden's go-to. It didn't really catch on. So now enter Mark Carney. This chap is the only man on the planet to have been governor of two G7 central banks. He was governor of the Bank of Canada and then governor of the Bank of England. So he must be super brainy and reliable. He's currently the United Nations Special Envoy for Climate Action, whatever that means. And he's talked about as a potential replacement for Dame Jacinda Trudeau as Prime Minister of the Dominion of Canada. According to Mark Carney, Brexit is to blame for inflation. Look at that. We laid out in advance of Brexit that this will be a negative supply shock for a period of time, and that the consequence of that will be a weaker pound, higher inflation, and weaker growth, he told the Daily Telegraph. There's no joy in saying, well, we told you so, because people are having to live with that reality. He does actually appear to be taking, I would say, I don't like to complain, but I think he actually is taking a little joy in saying, I told you so. This guy is very deliberate about what he says to the press. Last year, our friend Andrew Lawton tried to pin him down on a Canadian issue in Davos, and he wasn't permitted to speak outside a controlled environment.
Hi, Mr. Carney. Andrew Lawton with True North in Canada.
Nice to see you. I never do spontaneously.
I understand. My one question is, could the Canadian oil and gas sector survive the net zero approach that's being promoted here?
As I said, I never do. If you want an interview with me, like everybody else, you make a request and we can have it.
And will you accept that?
Like everybody else, if I can finish. Okay.
Yeah, as you heard, there's nothing spontaneous about Mark Carney. So his blaming of inflation on Brexit would seem, in contrast, rather calculated. Our stats man, Jamie Jenkins, is on the case. Jamie, how does Brexit cause inflation in, say, Germany and the United States?
Well, indeed, Mark. So let's look at the numbers. Many countries across the European Union, Mark, the last couple of years, have seen inflation much, much higher than the UK. There are countries in the European Union have had inflation below the UK. And what's pretty much driving inflation across most of the nations across the world, Mark, is the energy prices. And it all depends really on your energy mix and how much you're kind of exposed to the kind of the gas prices that have kind of gone up low. So Germany have had mass inflation. Spain actually had big inflation, but that's come down much, much quicker than the United Kingdom. So it all, and obviously it's a hot, warmer climate down there. So it depends on pretty much where you are. But that clip you just spread of Mark Carney there, Mark, pretty much to me, if he says, I can't have an interview without kind of doing a proper booking, he pretty much, he sums up what he's talking about here. Absolute nonsense. He doesn't want an interview with somebody outside of his normal protocol, because he probably wants to know, what are you going to ask me about? Let me get my briefing in and let me tell you the party line or whatever line he wants to tell you. He just, you know, this is absolute nonsense. And the thing is with Mark Carney, Mark, he kind of, he was in charge of the Bank of England, obviously, in the United Kingdom. That was a period of time where we still had very, very low interest rates. He probably could have upped them a little bit to try and get them from these historic lows that we had off the back of the financial crisis. But, you know, he's a globalist. He's blamed Brexit in the past for certain things. And he's already had to roll back himself by saying that all the doom and gloom that he thought Brexit would deliver actually hasn't happened. And for him to come on and say that Brexit is the cause of inflation when other countries in the European Union and beyond have had inflation proves that it's a bit of an agenda here, Mark. And remember, what we were talking about probably a couple of months ago, Mark, was we had other people blaming kind of delays at airports on Brexit. Everybody blames Brexit. I can imagine in 2050, Mark, you know, we probably won't be talking in 2050. We'll be long gone by then, probably. But in 2050, some people will say, oh, that's probably to do with Brexit.
Yeah. You have a preference among recent former governors of the Bank of England. You disdain Mark Carney, but you think Sir Mervyn King might be on to something.
Well, Mark, yeah, we've touched on this before on the show. So Mark Carney says Brexit is the cause of inflation. But if you just look at economic theory, simple economic theory, this is the kind of the 101 you're taught when you're doing your economics A level. You haven't even got to go to university to do this. That if you print loads and loads of money, if you increase the money supply, that will cause inflation. I think your producers have got what Mervyn King thinks is the cause of inflation at the start of all of this.
And central banks have lost control of inflation. Governments lost control of the public finance. Not surprising that markets respond to that.
And whose responsibility was it then, if both the central bank and the government lost control?
Well, I think all central banks in the West, interestingly, made the same mistake. And during COVID, when the economy was actually contracting because of lockdown, central banks decided it was a good time to print a lot of money. That was a mistake. That led to inflation. We had too much money chasing too few goods. And the result was inflation. That was predictable, it was predicted, and it happened.
And as you said, you don't have to have gone to university to get that, because that's basically the economics you would learn in high school or even younger.
And the critical couple of words that Mervyn King said there, Mark, it was predictable, and it happened. You know, it was predictable, all the stuff that they did. And the other thing he said is that they all made the same mistake. So let's look at this. Let's decipher this. Predictable and all made the same mistake. Same with lockdowns. All countries made the same mistake with lockdowns. And it was probably predictable that the health services across many nations would kind of collapse off the back of that as well. So you put all this and you start questioning, you know, people in, you know, public expect very respected, very intelligent people to be running these institutions. But if you mark the homework of the last 4 or 5 years, where obviously the pandemic itself had this big shock for the system, but you start marking the homework of what we've seen is the banks have really messed up. Who's winning at the moment, Mark? The banks are actually winning because interest rates are going up. The profits of banks are going through the roof. And I think that's probably a topic that we need to look into a little bit more over the coming months. But and then during the pandemic, who won? Well, all these people who had these links to these PPI contracts and the government paying absolute fortunes. So the public are losing an absolute fortune through all of this, Mark. Central banks have let us down. And I'm much more in the Mervyn King camp. He's got no skin in the game. Mervyn King is pretty much retired from public life. He pops up now and again to give his view as a former governor of the Bank of England. But what you've talked about, Mark Carney's still looking for that next big post that he wants to have. I'd rather trust Mervyn King's opinion on things, Mark, than Mark Carney. And if Canada are going to end up with Mark Carney, well, good help, you know, God help them.
Well, that's an interesting point in and of itself, isn't it? Sir Mervyn, whether he's retired or not, but he seems, by comparison, a sort of parochial figure. You know, you can introduce him on the BBC as a former governor of the Bank of England. Whereas for some reason I don't quite get, Mr. Carney, you called him a globalist, but he seems to bestride the world like a colossus. Here he is in Davos, or here he is at something in Malibu, or here he is at some conference in Tahiti. It's very strange the way a man who was not obviously successful simply rises ever upward.
Well, it's not the saying jack of, you know, all trades, but a master of none, because it's pretty clear he hasn't got no trade that he's a master of. Because if he's doing all of these things, you can't be an expert economics, expert in climate, expert in running countries. You know, Mark Carney seriously needs to, you know, knock it on the head if he still thinks Brexit. You know, I'm a stats guy, Mark. We've talked, you know, for the last year or so on numbers. You introduced a clip here today. You've only got to look at the data. If Brexit was to blame for the inflation in the United Kingdom, maybe you should put a call out for Mark Carney to come on the show. Let's ask him what is to blame for the inflation across the European Union.
Yeah.
Hungary, yeah. Turkey, yeah. USA. What are going to blame? He won't come on the show, Mark, because you will give him a proper grilling that he can't actually kind of control when he would agree to do a media interview with probably the people who want him on. And you won't give him the grilling.
No, and if he ever does decide he's going to be Prime Minister of Canada, you can bet that the CBC isn't going to give him any kind of a grilling on that. You also sent me a rather good quote from Mrs. Thatcher that you like the sound of.
Let us never forget this fundamental truth. The state has no source of money other than the money people earn themselves. If the state wishes to spend more, it can do so only by borrowing your savings or by taxing you more. And it's no good thinking that someone else will pay. That someone else is you. There is no such thing as public money. There is only taxpayers' money.
Yeah, she is on cracking form as usual there. In fact, you would think people understand that by now, because we were given all this free money during lockdown. People were being paid to stay at home. Oh, it's fantastic. We're closing all the businesses, but don't worry. You're going to be paid just to sit in your one-room flat all week long. And next thing you know, suddenly the United Kingdom has the highest tax burden since the end of the Second World War. People must be able to make the connection between these two things, don't you think?
The problem, Mark, is people can't make the connection and they're fools. So, you know, that clip there from Margaret Thatcher, you know, we're coming from an age where politicians on left and right, far more intelligence than what we've got today. You know, that golden era, you know, some people will criticize Margaret Thatcher for, you know, closing the mines and devastating some local economies, but she had far more intelligence than the current people we've got in today, Mark. So let's look at what she's talking about, though. She's right to hit the point that there is no such thing as kind of, you know, government's money. It's all our taxpayers' money at the end of the day. We had a huge bailout of people when we had the COVID pandemic, you know, the banks as well. We had the bank bailout back in 2008. That's what led to austerity across the United Kingdom and many other nations through that period from 2010 through to 2020. And where we are at the moment then, Mark, is now, you know, remember, I think we talked a bit about Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng's mini budget and this time about, you know, it might have been back end of September time. I can't remember exactly when they come in now. It's so many times things have passed. But, yeah. But the thing there was they got kicked out, Mark, because interest rates and the markets got kind of spooked. And at the moment, what we've got is the actual interest rates are much higher now than under that kind of regime. So Hunt and Sunak have failed us there. But let's look at some really critical numbers. You know, let's put the numbers on this when we talk about borrowing and who's their money. So in April 2023, a couple of months ago, the government borrowed £25.6 billion in the United Kingdom. Now, that's the second highest of the last 30 years. Mm. In the financial year ending 2023, Mark, they borrowed £137 billion. The total debt in the United Kingdom is £2.3 trillion. And the government is paying around £10 billion interest in April. £10 billion in April alone,
yep,
just on the interest of this debt. So to think that Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak have got a control on the finances much, much better than Truss and Kwarteng have is laughable, Mark. And I think we all got to come back to that Thatcher's quote. You know, this is not, you know, government's money, it's public money, and the finances have been absolutely shot.
Yeah, but it comes back to that sort of contrast between Mr. Carney and Sir Mervyn, is that there are some things you do that meet the disapproval of the global consensus, because the global consensus is entirely relaxed about its particular model of fiscal profligacy.
Well, I think the biggest issue is, Mark, you know, we'll have another election in the United Kingdom, we'll have elections in Germany, we'll have elections all over the different world. But with these countries, when you've got a debt of £2.3 trillion, Mark, it's laughable to think that people who vote decide who runs the country. The money markets will decide who runs the country, because when you own £2.3 trillion, when you've got, you know, 10 billion interest in a month, a course of a year, that's about £107 billion in the financial year in 2023. When you've got those kind of debt that you're kind of hanging over you, it's a bit like having a noose around your neck.
Mm.
So whoever's in charge of the country, you know, if Keir Starmer got voted in and he started coming up with policy that the money men and the money women didn't like, well, there'd be a big spook on the markets. The media would be all over it. So democracy, I think, Mark, has kind of died across many parts of the Western world because of these debts. It's pretty much not the voters deciding on the policies. It's pretty much the money men and the money women on terms of these markets. And that's the biggest travesty. We talk about the democratic deficit.
Yep.
That is the big thing. It's the money that drives what's going on, Mark. And people have got to wake up and look at the actual money themselves.
Oh, yeah, it's literally a democratic deficit, Jamie. The old, you know, whatever the old joke was, if you owe the bank £1,000, you have a problem. If you owe the bank £1,000,000, the bank has a problem. If you owe the bank, whatever you were saying, 2.6 trillion, then your country and indeed the entire civilized world has a problem. If this keeps up, it's not going to end anywhere good. Thank you very much, Jamie Jenkins. It's always good to see you. You can follow him at Twitter, at StatsJamie, or check out the website, statsjamie.co.uk. Thank you very much, Jamie. Let us get to the most important part of the show. That is you. Ken asks, you mentioned before how the Quebec independence referendum of 1995 failed because of the changing demographics in the years leading up to it. The future belongs to those who show up, as you often say. Just to clarify what Ken's talking about there, once upon a time, Quebec Catholics used to have 11 or 12 children. The former Canadian Prime Minister, Jean Chrétien, is one of 12 kids. That was fairly typical for Catholics in Quebec up until the 1960s. Then they stopped having kids, and as a result, come the 1995 independence referendum, there were insufficient Francophones to take that secession referendum over the finish line. If they'd continued having kids the way they did when Jean Chrétien was a lad, they would have their little independent La République Québécoise by now. Ken continues, if by some miracle it passed, it lost by a tad over 1%, would Quebec be any different today, or would it still be an exemplar of the contradictions of multiculturalism? No. If Quebec were to achieve independence, then I don't think it would have the open borders that the United States has or that Anglophone Canada has. They're rather more serious about that. And the fundamental thing is they believe in majority group rights. You can have a difference of opinion of that. They ban, for example, wearing burqas or other religious symbols if you're working in a Quebec government office. You might not like that. In Anglo-Canada, they say, oh, you know, why should we start banning costumes or all the rest of it? But the fact is, they're not in the suicide business in the same way that the United States and His Majesty's dominions, whether in Canada or the UK or elsewhere, are not in the suicide business. Larry Durham says, regarding boycotts, while it seems that Bud Light and Target appear to be taking some lumps for their alignment with big trans, are we too far gone for it to be a long-term strategy to ward off the insanity? These people insult you. The LA Dodgers have decided that they want to go with the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence a trans group, drag queens who mock nuns. Wix, the big DIY, do-it-yourself home improvement guys in the United Kingdom, have said they're not interested in having any transphobic customers in their stores. You know, this gets to that basic thing, you know, what is it, that meme on the internet, the Hitler thing? Oh, the two German guys sitting around, oh, are we the baddies? Yeah, yeah, when you're slicing the breasts off middle school girls, you're the baddies. If sports and corporations and beers want to get it, don't drink a beer that's in favour of slicing the breasts off middle school girls. Don't support a baseball team that wants to render prepubescent schoolboys impotent. You know, that's about as basic baddie and goodie a thing as you want. You can do what you like to me. Do what you like to grown-ups, but keep your hands off the breasts of middle school girls. It's not a lot to ask. Jeff says, I know many people are already sick of Bojo, but his fall is fascinating to watch. You need to get out more, Jeff. You really do. I am curious, though. He is a relatively young man. What does he do now? He doesn't want to get... I think he's just started a column at the Daily Mail. He's done that for 40 years. You know, I think I said on Thursday's show that he did all that stuff, doing a column, going on telly. He did all that on his way up. He doesn't want to go back to doing it on his way down. So look for him to become Klaus Schwab's even more evil deputy at Davos or something like that. But this Daily Mail, going on the telly stuff, he's done all that. He's done all that. He's done all that. He doesn't want to do it again for another 40 years. That'll do it for us. Lots more tomorrow. Stay safe. Stay free.